Welcome to our paranormal afterlife. This is our paranormal afterlife, and I'm your host, Simon Bowne. And if you want to hear the extended version of this episode, which is an extra 20 minutes, please join the Patreon campaign. This week I'm talking to Anthony Peake about his book, Near-Death Experiences: The Science, Psychology, and Anthropology Behind the Phenomenon. Anthony is a renowned author of 13 books, a researcher specializing in the study of consciousness, near-death experiences, and the nature of reality. His work delves into the realms of quantum physics, neurology, and psychology. Hi, Anthony. Thanks a lot for coming on the podcast.
You're most welcome, Simon.
So we're going to talk about your book, Near-Death Experiences, The Science, Psychology, and Anthropology Behind the Phenomenon. Do you feel that near-death experiences are a genuine separation between the body and consciousness, or are you on the fence?
From my research, and I've been researching the near-death experience now, both as a professional writer for over 25 years and an interest before then as well, I think it's far more complex than that. I think we need to start thinking, I hate the term outside of the box, but we need to start thinking more progressively about this because there are allied phenomena such as dimethyltryptamine experiences, alien encounters, out-of-body experiences, these things, all of which seem to link. And if we start applying neurology and we start applying our developing knowledge of quantum mechanics with regard to consciousness, we are rapidly coming to the conclusion that what we consider to be external reality, that is consensual reality, the reality that's presented us to by the senses, is not actually out there at all. There is no out there and in here. And therefore, your body and the body processes are as much part of something far deeper that I hope we can dig into a little bit. So to me, it is a question like, for instance, people turn around to me and say, well, the near-death experience is an hallucination. And my counter-argument to that is everything is an hallucination in the sense that the argument of an hallucination is something that is created by the brain. And we know from consciousness studies, we know that everything that we experience is created by the brain. The brain is processing information that it is being given from an external world, and it's inwardly modeling that information. And indeed, it is of great importance to note that researchers in this area call people who believe there's a one-to-one relationship between what you believe is out there and what is really out there are called naive realists. So to me, yes, of course it's real. You know, because the counter argument here is the one thing we experience every minute of our existence is that we are a conscious something, perceiving something. And that conscious something is considered to be an epiphenomenon of brain processes. But we cannot measure in any tangible way, and I'm using the word tangible in its literal sense, touchable, of what consciousness is. You know, way back in, I think it was 1994, a young philosopher called David Chalmers stood up at a big event at the University of Arizona and made the statement. He called there are the two great science problems of science. There's the soft problem of science, which is effectively how we understand the brain functions, but there's the hard problem of science, is how the brain creates self-referential consciousness, how it creates Simon and Anthony. And we're not even at first base at doing this. We do not know. So there's all this hubris around. And I suspect we are at the equivalent position now in terms of this form of science as the medieval schoolmen when they were trying to explain retrograde motion by coming up with concepts such as epicycles. Our science has gone off on a wrong direction, and we're so preoccupied with material reductionism, which is a very effective way of looking at the world, but we're missing the point. Each one of us, even the most sort of focused denier, the Daniel Dennetts of this world and the Churchillans, the eliminative materialists, cannot get away from the fact that they exist and they are a consciousness. Well, sadly enough, Daniel Dennett doesn't anymore because he died recently. So he will now know something we don't know, which is whether there is life after death.
So you say that your intention with this book was to bring together some of the more neglected areas of near-death experiences. So what are those neglected areas?
Well, to me, when, you know, having read most books on near-death experiences over the last 3 or 4 decades, and indeed in research for this book, reading virtually every single academic paper that's been written on near-death experiences for the last 50 years, I feel that a point is being missed. All books, or the vast majority of books that you read on near-death experiences, are literally a list of "it happened to me" experiences, which is fascinating and it's really, really interesting, but it's not explaining what it is. What it's doing is it's describing the experience from subjective viewpoints, but it is self-evident from the subjective viewpoints that we know from the reports is that it is clearly linked to anthropology, it's linked to sociology, it's linked to social programming, because it has to be. Because, for instance, I can find no cases anywhere of a fundamentalist Christian having a near-death experience in which they encounter Brahman or they encounter non-Christian entities. And the corollary is I can find no people who have had Buddhist near-death experiences or Hindu near-death experiences that encountered Jesus or the saints and everything else as well. So clearly there is something going on here that is far more deeply rooted. And I argue, and I've argued in a number of books that I've written on the UFO phenomenon as well, that what we're doing is it's our expectations of what we experience that creates the experience itself. Or the counter-argument is the experience modulates itself depending upon what we expect it to do. In other words, it's something external to us, but the way our brain, as I said earlier on, which processes our reality, interprets that information is of crucial importance. And this is why I want to take a very strongly anthropological, and I am by training a sociologist, and a sociological viewpoint on this, to say, well, let's start looking at the soft sciences, the social sciences elements of this. Then let's put into this the hard science. What do we know is really taking place in the brain when somebody experiences a near-death experience? What neurochemicals are active there? What neurotransmitters are active? And then we start to really then start to look. And then we need to add to that, what can this tell us about the true nature of reality? So to me, I really wanted to write a book that was radically different in approach, but still use the old tropes, you know, and I reference, you know, all the great writers that have been involved, you know, Melvin Morse, Kenneth Ring, everybody that was involved in it. And I cite a series of important cases. But for me, to progress and understand, we can't just keep going around in a loop of saying, Doris had a near experience and this is what happened to her. Fred had a near experience and this is what happened to him. It's all well and good, but it's not progressing it. It's just a series of stories.
You talk about we get what we might expect to get when we have one of these experiences.
Yeah.
That might be because this is the near-death experiences in society. They're in the media. But there are people who reported them, like Ogston, who's in your book. Was it 1911 or 1906?
What I'm not saying is that the media influence people into seeing things in particular ways, but to an extent they do. But the near-death experience itself melds itself to accommodate our expectations. It's a subtle but important difference. I mean, in my research, for instance, I can go back to near-death experiences going back way before even the much-cited case of the myth of Ur. You can go back even further. You can find near-death experiences in every culture on Earth. But each culture on Earth interprets the near-death experience in a subtly different way. For example, I have a whole section in the book of near-death experiences within Iran and within, you know, the original belief systems in Iran before Islam came there, you know, Zoroastrianism. And if you start looking into the depths of Zoroastrianism, you find that there are incredible near-death experiences being described there. And there is an associate of mine called Greg Shugram, and he's been doing some fascinating work on the anthropology of the near-death experience. So rather similarly to the way the UFO experience melds itself to our expectations, so does the near-death experience. So it's very, very culturally based. But it doesn't mean it's not real. And this is the most important point we have to make here, is that the whole concept of reality, if we start looking into quantum mechanics, reality itself is an issue here. And of course, the word real comes from reality. So we've got to be looking deeper here, because if consciousness is prime, which I believe it is, and if consciousness is effectively creating the world around us by technically what is called collapsing the wave function within quantum mechanics, that means that the reality we perceive around us is modulated by us. And in this, I have a concept I call the egregorial. And egregore is from the Greek egregorus, which is watchers. But effectively, I argue that egregores are created by us. They are social tropes. I mean, marketing knows how to create an egregore. We know in social media now the way things just take on a life of their own. And it's linked here to things like tulpas, mind-created ghosts. I mean, again, in an earlier book, I cite the case of the Philip experiment in 1970 in Canada, in Toronto, where a group of people created a spirit. And that spirit manifested, even though they had gone out of their way to actually create a backstory of who this spirit was and who he was. And they said it was a guy called Aylesford who lived in the Midlands in England during the final years of the English Civil War. And he never existed. But the entity started manifesting. Not only did the entity start manifesting, but it started moving tables and twisting them. In fact, if you go online, there's this amazing film from Canadian television where the group of researchers are on live television and the table levitates and starts moving around. Now, this to me is self-evident that the power of the human mind is greater than we can even begin to understand. So in which case, when we talk about near-death experiences, UFO counters, out-of-body experiences, all these things, these are brain-created, but the brain is using its abilities to bring into existence the reality around us, subliminally and probably unconsciously. But you get what you expect, you know, because they can't all be right. You can't have the near... If you look at near-death experiences, they are so different culturally. They have the similar themes inside. It's like there's an initial structure, but then there's the accretion of the anthropology and the sociology and the cultural aspects, which changes it. So either the people die and they go to heaven and they see Jesus, which they do in Christian cultures, or they go into a state of limbo, or they go into the Bardo state, according to Buddhists. They can't both be right. So the argument is they are both right and both wrong, in the sense that they are seeing what they expect to see, if again that makes sense.
Yeah, I mean, there is a spiritual point of view of maybe there's some spirit in charge of their near-death experience and they know that person so well, they give them exactly what they need, what will be the best for them.
Oh, totally. And of course, if you've read my earlier books, you will know exactly what I consider that spirit to be. I call it the daemon. And I argue that it is the daemon effectively that facilitates the near-death experience in the first place. And the daemon is in effect manifest as in the Moody trait of the being of light. If you look at the reports of the being of light throughout history, the being of light is totally manifest differently for different people. It can manifest as being a religious figure. It can manifest as Jesus. It can manifest as whatever your God is. But it also manifests in other ways. Like, for example, one of the big problems that people have with near-death experiences, and it's not reported that often, but I report it in the book, is that children report in near-death experiences encountering living people. Living people guide them and talk to them. These people aren't dead. You also have cases where children in near-death experiences encounter Mickey Mouse or cartoon characters. Now, these cartoon characters self-evidently don't exist, but if my egregorial hypothesis is correct, they exist in a way because the children create them in their mind and they're expecting them. So my argument here is that the being of light is, in fact, for want of a cruder term, is a manifestation of our own higher self. But because I do the science, it's more complex than that. It's to do with the dominant and non-dominant hemispheres of the brain. It's to do with the communication channels within the dominant and non-dominant parts of the brain. And the daemon is effectively your immortal self. It is, for want of a better term, your soul. And it's much more complex than that. And again, I do the science of this in previous books as to exactly what this entity is. And it's literally the entity that at the point of death, we split into two separate consciousnesses, the Eidolon and the daemon. And the Eidolon is the person who, in a near-death experience, experiences the near-death experience, facilitated and guided by the daemon. Because the one thing that is of profound importance here is the near-death experience is exactly what it says it is. It is a near-death experience. It's not a real death experience. Nobody has ever come back from being brain dead. Nobody, ever. If you're brain dead, you're brain dead. Okay? You don't come back. And my argument is that that's when the real death experience takes place, where we can take certain of the moody traits and can realize that they are kind of watered-down versions of a much greater experience that takes place when you really die. And I use the analogy, you know, for instance, the Panoramic Life Review, you know, one of the moody traits, regularly reported my life flash before my eyes. And I've always been extremely interested in this as to why the life flashes before your eyes or why you get a series of snapshots of incidents in your life. Why does it do that? And I use the analogy that literally what I believe takes place is when death starts, consciousness splits into two, the Eidolon and the daemon. And the daemon realizes it's an independent consciousness from the Eidolon. And it realizes it has to facilitate the near-death experience, including a life review. But a life review that is a literal minute-by-minute recreation of your life. But because it is a near-death experience, the daemon realizes this and metaphorically, as if there's a recording of your life, presses the fast forward because it knows that you're not actually really going to die. And in doing so, the Eidolon perceives their life flashing in front of their eyes because it literally does. It's like you're sitting in front, or more complexly, you're within a virtual reality model of your life. And suddenly somebody presses the fast forward. And suddenly you see, and everything goes super fast. And I believe that is what takes place. And that is the central concept of my cheating the ferryman hypothesis, which uses the near-death experience to give a much more powerful explanation of what happens to human consciousness at this point of death.
So can we talk about the discoveries of Wilder Penfield? Because I was fascinated by his experiments.
Oh, it's extraordinary, isn't it, what happened with Penfield. Penfield was a fascinating man. He was born in the United States, but moved to Canada when he was quite young. And what had happened was his sister had died of complications due to epilepsy. And he really wanted to try and find a cure for epilepsy. But of course, in order to cure epilepsy, they needed to understand what was going on in the brain. So in order to do that, they needed to map the brain to know what parts of the cerebral cortex did what. And Penfield realized that the human brain doesn't feel pain. The skull does and the skin around the skull, but the actual brain itself doesn't feel pain. So if you are a very skilled surgeon, you can take a section out of the skull of somebody who is conscious with just a local anesthetic around the areas where the skull has been cut out. And while they're conscious, you can actually touch the surface of the cerebral cortex, which is exposed when the skull is, when the part of the skull has been taken out. Now, the reason he did this was he wanted to know what parts of the brain did what. So he would take part of the skull out and he had a little electrode pen and he'd place it on the surface of the brain and he'd ask the person what they were perceiving. So the person would suddenly say, for example, I'm suddenly seeing the color red everywhere. He realized that he was in a position there that he knows that that's the area that is processing vision in some way. And over a period of time, he was able to map the brain. The reason he wanted to map the brain was he'd realized that the only way you can stop a seizure spreading across the brain from the one hemisphere to the other is to do what firemen do when there's a forest fire. That is, cut out a trench around the fire to keep it located in one place or another. But in order to do that, he wanted to make sure he wasn't cutting out important parts of the brain to do it. And this is why he did this map. And he ended up with a map of what parts of the brain did what at the surface level anyway. But when he got to the temporal lobes, which are the areas around the ears, either side, the right and left temporal lobes, something extraordinary happened. Because when he pressed the electrode onto the exposed brain of certain individuals, they suddenly found themselves back at a point in their own past. And there's one classic example where, I'm paraphrasing here, where he placed the electrode on a lady's temporal lobes. And she said, "Good Lord, I'm back in my kitchen 20, 25 years ago. And I can feel the wind coming in through the kitchen window and everything else." And then she goes, "My God, it's my son, Johnny. He's calling me." And Penfield said to her, "What you're imagining it?" She said, "No, I'm really there. I'm really there. I know I'm in an operating theatre in Montreal, but I'm also part of my past." So what Penfield did was he took the electrode pen off. And when he did so, she said, "What did you do? It's gone." And he then asked her about her son. And while he'd got her talking about that, he pressed the electrode on the same spot and it started again, in exactly the same point, as if literally he'd paused the past life review, then had pressed it again and it started again. Now, he reproduced this many, many times. And towards the end of his life, he was absolutely convinced that the human brain records every single experience we have, every single sensual experience, visual experience, smell experience, the lot. It's all encoded in the brain. So the brain has literally a record of every experience we've had. But as he rightly said, what's the point of that? Why would the brain do this? Because everyday consciousness cannot access this information. It's an analogy. It's like having the secrets of your whole life locked in a safe with the key locked in the safe. It makes no sense. But my hypothesis, cheating the ferryman, says it makes very good sense, because this memory, these memories are encoded for a particular reason. They're encoded because they are the initial functioning processing of the panoramic life review. That's why they're there. Now, you'll know, as you mentioned to me earlier, as a hypnotist, you know that you can hypnotize people and take them back to parts of their life. And in one of my earlier books, I argue this. There was cases like, there was the Chowchilla case in California in, I think, the 1960s. And a group of children were hijacked for some bizarre reason, which I've never understood. There was a school bus that was hijacked. And the bus driver was kicked out the bus. And the hijackers took the kids and they buried the bus with the kids in them for some reason. Didn't kill them, but buried the bus. The police were desperate to know what had happened. So a person like yourself came along, a professional hypnotist, and he hypnotized the bus driver. And he hypnotized the bus driver back to the point where the car drove in front of his coach. And by taking him back to reliving that moment again in his life, he was able to read the number plate on the car. And by reading the number plate, they were able to find the people who had done it and rescue the children. Now, this shows to me that human memory is far more powerful. Now, the question then is, where is human memory located in the brain? There has been experiments done. There was a guy called Carl Pribram that did experiments years ago where he tried to find the location of memory, the Enneagram, the place that where memory is located in the brain. But he'd never found it. In the end, he came to the conclusion that that memory is nowhere and everywhere in the brain. And I argue this is because memory doesn't work in the way we think it does. Memory is processed usually by the amygdala, which is an area near the temporal lobes. But that's only the processor. Where the recordings are held is completely different. And I think it's recorded non-locally within the brain using holographic principles. It's a holographic process within the brain. And this is exactly what Carl Pribram argued. By the way, I got that wrong. It wasn't Pribram. It was somebody else that did the experiments there. But Carl Pribram, who was a psychologist at the University of Georgetown, came to the conclusion that the brain works under holographic principles and memory works under holographic principles. And this is why we have, and I'll guarantee that everybody out there has them, they're called charged memories. It's when you have these memories of your past that are really powerful, but they're not a memory of something extraordinary, like somebody coming in and telling you that you're family have been killed. They're just the oddest of things. I mean, I have a powerful memory of being in my cot and listening to church bells. Why do I remember that to such intensity? I can close my eyes now and actually be there. And a lady called Esther Salomon, who was a Russian writer, came to the conclusion these charged memories are bits where, as I've argued, literally where the recording process is supersaturated. You know, imagine like an old tape. And the tape is recording your memories. There'll be certain bits where the chemicals in the tape are sort of supersaturated. And they're the bits where you have these kind of powerful memories. And we also have spontaneous memories. And again, your argument of how you can take somebody back and you can reconstruct that memory and get more information. And I argue this is because this is how holograms work. Because holograms, as you probably know, a holographic image, if you smash a holographic image, it's not like a jigsaw where you break it apart and there's a little bit of the image in each bit, you know, part of the image. The whole image is in every part of it. So every part of a smashed holographic image has a denuded image of the whole image. And this is what a guy called David Bohm, who was a quantum physicist, argued this is how reality works. This is how the universe works. Everything is enfolded in itself. So within your brain, effectively is the universe. And as I said in one of my books, you will find in a tear of your eye the Andromeda galaxy. So this is how the enfoldment takes place and how memories are processed. A very long answer to a very short question, so my apologies, but I need to put these things in context.
You're saying if memories are non-local, then that could explain how people, when they're getting CPR and they're completely out, their heart stopped, they can make memories of the near-death experience, like veridical, correct, verified ones.
Correct, because this is the issue here. You know, when there is no anything happening in the brain, how are memories processed? So, I mean, we can counter-argue and say, you know, there's evidence to say that the Pam Reynolds case, they were memories she was recalling when she was coming to after she'd had the bypass operation. But she was flatlined. So even if she had been so, how did her brain process it? Now, there is a counter-argument to say with the Pam Reynolds case and the Keith Augustine critique of it, and I think it's Worley's critique as well, argues that, well, it was before she was flatlined. But there are so many other cases where people are clinically dead, if not brain dead, but clinically dead, which they might as well be because there's no brain activity. But they remember things. And not only that, but they're experiencing things. So where are these experiences come from? And I argue they're being drawn up from technically the quantum vacuum, processing with the zero-point field and things called Bose-Einstein condensates. And Bose-Einstein condensates effectively can draw up information via the microtubules within the neurons of the brain. This is, again, related to something called orchestrated objective reduction. which is a hypothesis of consciousness put forward by Nobel Prize winning mathematician Sir Roger Penrose and his associate and anesthesiologist by the name of Stuart Hammerhoff from the University of Arizona. And they argue that, again, it's quantum effects. What happens is that the neurons of the brain, and I would counter-argue and say it's not the neurons, it's the glial cells, which we can touch on later, but the neurons themselves are drawing up information from a huge information field, which exists within the vacuum of space. And that, because I said before about the enfoldment, everything is already in there. So your observation there about how consciousness can generate memory in a state where the brain is not active, that's the argument. I argue that's exactly what is happening.
Hello, Simon here. I conduct past life regression therapy sessions over Zoom, and these sessions can be very insightful and healing. If you go to my website, pastlifeshypnosis.co.uk, you can book a free 20-minute consultation where we can discuss what it is you would like to achieve. You'll find the link to my website in the show notes. You mention in the book that there's evidence in Israel that humans believed in the afterlife 100,000 years ago.
Oh, yeah. No, totally. I mean, we have from cave paintings and everything else evidence of the idea of an afterlife. But as somebody who studied the sociology of religion at university many years ago, you know, there is the counter-argument to say, well, it is logical to conclude that your loved ones and the people around you die and you don't know where they've gone. So you will assume that they've gone somewhere else. They've gone to another location or another place. But then you have the issue of when people take hallucinatory substances, such as ayahuasca or dimethyltryptamine, psilocybin, magic mushrooms. Because when that happens, people go into an out-of-body state where they encounter entities, they encounter dead people, they communicate with these dead people, they communicate with the ancestors, and they then bring information back to the tribe and to the group that become useful. I'll give an example of this, how extraordinary this is, if you can bear with me for a second, because it's going slightly off on a tangent, but it's very important to make this point, that one of the great mysteries of modern anthropology is the mystery of ayahuasca. Now, ayahuasca is a substance that it's a brew, it's a tea, it's a drink that the indigenous cultures in Amazonia have been drinking for centuries. Now, the intriguing thing about the ayahuasca brew is it is made of two separate plants, uniquely two separate plants, Banisteriasis capi and Psychiatra viridis. Okay, two very different plants. The Banisteriasis capi is a vine, what's called the vine of death, actually, amazingly enough. And the Psychiatra viridis, I think, is a little white flower. Now, the two are mixed together, and the person drinks the brew, and they have these extraordinary viridical out-of-body experiences. Now, the mystery is how they came to make this brew, because there's something very important that takes place physiologically. If you took the psychiatric aspect, which I think is the Psychiatra viridis, the leaves, and you chewed them, the DMT would come out of the leaves, and you'd swallow it, and it would go into your stomach. But when it goes into your stomach, the lining of the stomach excretes something called monoamine oxidase, MAO. And it does it for a reason, because monoamine oxidase is an inhibitor. And what it does is it inhibits the ability of the hallucinatory elements of the substance to cross into the bloodstream. It stops it doing it. So then they did some experiments and they discovered something really unique. The Banisteriasis capi, I presume it's that one, I'm never quite sure which one is which, so I stand corrected and be happy to do that, contains something called harmaline, which is, they've discovered, is an MAO inhibitor. So by putting that into the drink, when the hallucinatory substance goes into your stomach and the MAO comes out to stop it, the MAO inhibitor that's found in the other plant reacts against the MAO and stops it doing what it's supposed to do, which then allows the hallucinatory substance to go into the bloodstream and up into the brain and cause the experiences. Now, they've known about this brew for centuries. So when the anthropologists talked to the shamans, they said, how did you know? There are literally, I think, 10 or 15,000 at least different types of plants in the Amazon basin. How did they have the two plants that would work together perfectly with no knowledge of chemistry or how the stomach works? When the shamans were asked, the shamans said, the entities and the plants told us. And they asked further, and apparently what would happen is that shamans, you know, train themselves to get into out-of-body states, to go to the land of the dead, to meet the ancestors. And when they went into this place, they were greeted by entities that looked like plants. And the entities would talk to them, and the entities, apparently, legend has it, that the entities would take the shamans into this hallucinatory jungle and say, you need to pick this plant here, and you need to mix this plant with that plant, bring them together, then not only you, but all normal people who take this brew can also experience this world. Now, isn't that extraordinary? There is no understanding of that except the argument that the entities that people came across in those circumstances have actually are independent of us and have knowledge we do not have. And this is exactly what my friends are now discovering at Imperial College in London. There's a series of experiments being done at the moment with volunteers with intravenously injected dimethyltryptamine. And they're taking the dimethyltryptamine intravenously and going into altered states of consciousness. They are meeting entities there. One of my friends went into this state. He's a university professor, he's a lecturer and everything else. Went into this alternate state, found himself which is called the DMT cage. And he's floating in space, and suddenly this entity, this mantoid creature, comes over and taps him on the shoulder and says, you shouldn't be doing it this way. This is wrong. Do not do it this way. And receded back. He then comes back down from the hallucinatory state to explain to his friends what he'd seen. 2 weeks later, he's injected again, goes into the state. He's in the state. The same creature comes over and says, I told you last time, this is not the way you should be doing it. Now, as Carl has said to me, that being, if that was just a projection of my subconscious, it was telling me things I didn't want to hear. And he said, and it wasn't a subjection of my conflict. It had been waiting for me. It had been somewhere else in the intervening period doing whatever it did. And it was waiting for me to come back. Now, this tells us again about what reality really is. So when you're in an out-of-body experience, when you are in a near-death experience, these entities are not just hallucinations. They are hallucinations, but they are real. You know, as we know, you will know, don't know you, about the famous case of Eben Alexander.
Yeah.
You know, when Eben Alexander went into his out-of-body state, and by the way, and I'll tell you something extraordinary about this, and I don't know if you've got to the part in the book, Eben Alexander features in my book because he's one of the few people that has actually taken 5-MeO-DMT and had a near-death experience. And the guy that writes the foreword to my book, which is one of the world's up-and-coming young neuroscientists, a guy called Dr. Pascal Michael, interviewed Eben and wrote an academic paper on it because Eben describes the similarities between a DMT experience and an NDE. Profoundly important. But going back, when Eben had his experience, do you remember he originally comes out, he's in this mud state, and he comes out and he rises up. And the next thing, he finds himself sitting on the wings of a huge butterfly. Insectoid. This is exactly the same as the DMT entities. And he's floating on the wings. And sitting next to him is this beautiful young woman with extraordinary colored eyes. And the woman talks to him. And then when he recovers from the meningitis and comes to, and of course at that stage he was virtually flatlined, so again, where these dreams were coming from cannot be explained. He was flatlined. He knows that. He was a surgeon himself, a neurosurgeon. So when he comes to, he's talking to his parents and he describes the young woman he saw, and his parents go really quiet and they say, there's something we need to tell you, which we've kept from you. You had a sister that died before you were born, and she had these coloured eyes. Now, that's veridical, as you say. You know, it's a veridical bringing back information from somewhere else that he could not have known. So where did that information come from? The information field that he attuned into when his consciousness was creating this hallucination based out of his expectations, but it was being just as real.
When people drink ayahuasca and have that kind of a experience, does it change people, like near-death experiences change people?
Yeah, like Penny Satori has written in her recent book, and various other people, you know, the way these people change rapidly. Totally, completely and utterly. Friends of mine who have taken, it's interesting, people who take dimethyltryptamine, it changes them in the sense they realize that the reality they go to when they go to the DMT reality, they realize that that reality is far more real than this one. It's this that's the hallucination, as far as they're concerned. This is the simulation. The real universe is the place they go to. But they still have their sense of identity. They still go there. When Carl had his experience, he was still mentally Carl. However, with 5-MeO-DMT, which, funnily enough, is an excretion of the Sonarian desert toad. The desert toad literally sweats this stuff, which again reminds me, you know, the old line of kissing toads, the fairy story, and kissing frogs. It could be this is where it came from. So when we take 5-MeO-DMT, as associates of mine have told me, you completely go into a place where you cease to be you. You become everything. You experience the idea of consciousness is everything, and you are an emanation of a greater consciousness, which is everything, and you become part of that. And I know from near-death experiences, some have reported exactly this sensation. And of course, we know that this is the perennial philosophy of Aldous Huxley. It's the idea, and in my books, I deal with this in great detail, the mechanisms and the meaning behind this, that you see the universe in a completely different way. I mean, funnily enough, a friend of mine, I'm not sure if I cite this case in the book, so remind me if I do. The guy who fell in the sea off Dawlish, a guy called Bill Murtha, and he was knocked off his bike one March day in 1999. He was cycling along the towpath in Dawlish in Devon. And he ended up in the sea, and he was dying of hypothermia. And when he was dying in the water, he described to me, and indeed as described in his book, he suddenly realized that he was the sea around him. He was the cliffs. He was the seagulls in the sky. And he realized that all consciousness is one. As Bill Hicks said, the American comedian, we are one consciousness experiencing itself subjectively. You know, and this is so true. And you go into these altered states and you find this. And interestingly enough, when Bill was dying in the water, his daemon manifested as well. And he had a past life review and he had a future review. And in the future review, he saw a universe that never happened because he survived his near-death experience. And he saw the impact of his death on his family. He actually found himself floating in the hallway of his house, looking down, and he heard the front door knock. And his daughters and his wife went to the front door, and it was a police officer reporting his death to his children and his wife. And he felt all their fears and everything else as well. Then he found himself back in the water. And of course, this is how it works, because according to my hypothesis, we are living in a simulation of our lives, but that simulation contains the outcome of every decision we can possibly make. So rather like a third-person computer game, when you die, when you're in the near-death experience, or what I call the RDE, or what I technically call Bohmian IMAX, when you are there, you are like in a computer game of your life where everything is already programmed. So every decision you make in that second life, when you live your life again, which I argue you do, you can fulfill any path you want. You're like Connors in Groundhog Day. In fact, the Russian language edition of my first book was called Groundhog Life. So you have alternate futures. And this is what people like Phyllis Atwater discusses in her near-death experience, the way she saw alternate realities that were outcomes of decisions she had not yet made and decisions she would never make. And this is reported many times by NDEers, which is not generally reported, but it's as much a phenomenon as the general I went into heaven and met God. And it's the idea that people see alternate futures, as Raymond Moody argued with his work, and Kenneth Ring, you know, with his research into it all. You know, these guys know that it's a much richer experience than just I go to heaven and I meet Jesus. You know, there's much more to it than that.
So there's an idea there of perhaps a multiverse?
It is.
I interviewed a man who wrote a book about coma and near-death experience. And he interviewed all these people who'd been in coma. But there was one small amount of people who said, while they were in a coma, they lived another life. And there was a guy who was in a coma for 7 days. And he said, no, I lived 22 years on another earth. And that life was just the same as this one. And when I came to here, I thought this was the dream. And it was that thing of him saying he worked 9 to 5. He went home. He had an apartment. He even fought for a year in a war in Southeast Asia in a country that doesn't exist on this earth.
This is quite extraordinary. And I have numerous cases of people who have done exactly this. I have a friend of mine, and she is an out-of-body experiencer. And for years, she goes to a place she calls Future Tokyo. And in Future Tokyo, she's an android. And she sees her own reflection in things. She knows the places she goes because she goes there every time. And she knows her job. She actually works on undersea cables. She is immersed and she's working on undersea cables. And every time she goes back, it's the same place. Now, to me, this is again showing that we're one singular consciousness experiencing itself subjectively. So in which case, what happens when you go into these altered states of consciousness? Your consciousness expands. Again, I mentioned this earlier. I said that people living our lives linearly within this Bohmian IMAX, within this life, are called Eidolons. And an Eidolon lives once. But the next level above is what I call a daemon, which is the personality of that person that lives all the lives and remembers them, like a game player of a game of life where you follow all your life up that you can theoretically do as you. But I then argue at the end of my last book, Cheating the Ferryman, I argue that there's another level above that, which I call the uberdaemon. And the uberdaemon is my equivalent of the Jungian collective unconscious. It is the being, the sentience, that has the ability to know of all human experiences, both future and past, and indeed elsewhere. And when your consciousness moves from the daemon into the consciousness of the uberdaemon, is when you can access past life memories. It's when you can access alternate realities. Now, this is then fascinating because it ties in completely with the many worlds interpretation, or as it has morphed into the many minds interpretation of quantum mechanics, which was first suggested in 1957 by a guy called Hugh Everett III in his PhD thesis, where he was trying to get over something about the mysteries of the Copenhagen interpretation of Niels Bohr and his associates, which in technical terms suggests that consciousness creates reality. He didn't like that. So he wanted to reinterpret it. And he argued that by using Schrödinger's cat experiment, you can argue that what happens is when the box is opened and the cat is revealed, one scientist sees a dead cat and one scientist sees a live cat. So the scientist has already moved into an alternate reality. And there is growing evidence that the many worlds interpretation or the many minds interpretation holds water. You know, there's more and more experimentation coming on to say that what reality really is like those nested Russian dolls. There are different times that are layered on top of each other. There's times that go orthogonal, that is in right direct, in a right angle from linear time. And consciousness can go into these locations and can then access other consciousnesses. And I argue this is what happens when people remote view. This is what happens when people sometimes have out-of-the-body experiences. They're looking through the eyes of somebody else. Now, the great example of this is the guy that started the whole modern out-of-the-body experience, whose name has suddenly escaped me.
It's not Monroe, is it?
Yeah, Robert Monroe, Bob Monroe. When, if you read Bob Monroe's book, The Journeys Out of the Body, you find something extraordinary. Because what happens is he goes into another person's brain and experience, and he calls that person either. And there's one classic example in one of his books. And I wrote a book on out-of-body experiences, by the way, a few years ago. I mean, this is my book. So this is the new book. It's now my 13th book on the subject. So when Robert Monroe went out-of-body, he would suddenly find himself looking out of the eyes of somebody who existed in a totally different version of Earth. And there was one time, and it's a lovely story, there's one time where he found himself in this guy's body. And as he finds himself in the guy's body, there's somebody sitting opposite him, and he's in a business meeting. And he's negotiating something with this person in a business meeting in his house. And his wife from that place, because he'd been in the body before, is looking at him really strangely because he suddenly doesn't realize what he's talking about. He's having an absence seizure. I'd argue that this is linked with temporal lobe epilepsy and everything. So he's having an absence seizure and he doesn't know what to say. And everybody's looking at him really weirdly. And then he suddenly finds himself rising up and he ends up somewhere else. And again, if you're interested, a friend of mine has done a short movie based upon this principle, which you will find. I'll send you the link. It's quite fascinating how he does it. It's he found this incredibly strange town in Croatia where he filmed it, which looks different from anywhere on Earth. You know, it's really weird. So you can attune into other people's consciousnesses. And this is because we're all one single consciousness. And clearly, these many lives and actually sort of sharing somebody else's consciousness is extraordinary. I'm going to be talking to a guy in a couple of weeks' time who spent 9 years as somebody else completely. He was still him, but in a totally different universe where he had a different name and he was married to a different person. He was doing a different job. And again, this happens often. People just don't talk about these things. And this is why it's so important. And I think this is why my book, I hope, will break through the barrier, because I do the science. So, you know, I'm challenging the scientists, I'm challenging the materialist reductionists to say, hey, guys, I played you at your own game. And I can prove that near-death experiences are real. What are you going to do about it now? You can easily dismiss a lot of the people that write about near-death experiences because they don't do the science. I'm using your science. I'm not moving away from any of your science to prove that the near-death experience, out-of-body experiences, and all these experiences are not only real, but a part of everyday nature.
We've been talking about the book Near-Death Experiences, the Science, Psychology, and Anthropology Behind the Phenomenon. People can get that on Amazon. Can they get all your other books on Amazon?
I'm comparatively unusual in the people who write in these themes in that I'm traditionally published. So my publishers actually pay me to write the books, which means that they have distribution far greater than you would normally expect. So, for instance, anywhere around the world, you can get hold of my books. You can order them from your local bookshop. Your local bookshop may have them on the shelves. If not, you can definitely order them from there. You can also order your book, or any of my books, from your local library. Your local council will probably have my books in the library, multiple copies of them probably. Or you can order them from the British Library in Boston Spa, where you can get them there. They're on all the online retailers like Amazon. My books are also in Kindle, so you can listen to them in Kindle. You can read them in Kindle. Also, six of my books are in Audible with me reading them. I had to actually audition to be able to read my own books, but I passed the audition. I had the right kind of voice for it, apparently. And people really do enjoy that. And I have to say that the best way of accessing my work is probably via Audible, because it's just so much fun listening to it and everything else as well, because you can then switch off and you can listen while you're jogging and everything else as well. But they're all, it's even, they're even in Braille if you're blind and you can't see. So they're Braille, so they're everything there. So just check them out. You can also buy signed copies off my own website, which is anthonypeake.com. I would suggest, again, if you are based in the UK, that probably makes rational sense, because I only charge the same as a bookshop would charge, plus postage and packing, which I then sign and give a dedication to. And in fact, the issue in the UK at the moment is there's a problem with the distributors of one of my publishers. So the book in the UK, the paperback version won't be available until the 1st of March. But breaking news, they're going to get a special print run done for me, which I will have books that I'll be able to sell off my website in advance. And there will be a special, unique, one-off gift available with the book if you buy it off the website. So with that, you will get a numbered one and a pre-order edition of as well, if you're interested. I also, if anybody's interested in my work, I'm very active on Facebook. I'm very active on Instagram. And I also have my own YouTube channel. And a lot of the people I've mentioned in this interview, I interview one-to-one on that website. And you will find some extraordinary material in there. Some of the world's leading researchers in this subject are on there. So check it out, see what you think.
Thanks a lot for that. Thanks a lot for coming on the podcast.
It's all right, Si. Thank you very much.
So this week I was talking to Anthony Peake about his book, Near-Death Experiences, The Science, Psychology and Anthropology Behind the Phenomenon. And a great way to support the podcast is to sign up to Patreon, where you can get exclusive access to the extended version of this episode. Just go to patreon.com/ourparanormalafterlife. When you sign up, you get access to the episodes in the back catalogue, and they are ad-free and are released 2 days before the free versions. And if you want to try out the extended episodes, you can now get a 7-day free trial. But my website is pastliveshypnosis.co.uk. The link is in the show notes. And if you enjoy this podcast, please leave a review and be sure to subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or via your favourite podcast app to make sure that you don't miss out on any episodes.